glories to Srila Prabhupada, all glories to the seminal devotees all over the world. Today is a most auspicious day because today we get the opportunity to glorify the person Bhagwat. The person Bhagwat is more important than the book Bhagwat. Why? Because without the person Bhagwat, there is no book Bhagwat. So the person Bhagwat and his Leela and his pastimes are very important because all of these pastimes revolve around Krishna, Lord Chaitanya, and Prabhupada's devotees. Prabhupada was never alone. He was always with his devotees, except in the early days when he was homeless in New York City for 10 months. He didn't have a place. He had to move from one place to another. Anyway, before I begin, I want to... Some devotees from the Chippewada Temple in Delhi. The Chippewada Temple in Delhi is very important because Prabhupada actually spent more time in the Chippewada Temple in Delhi than he did in Radha Damodar, because he was writing his books. He had to buy the paper. In those days, when you went to a printer, the printer didn't have any paper. You had to go buy the paper. And Prabhupada would carry the paper on his head through Chandichok. How many of you have been to Chandichok? Well, it's kind of difficult to walk around with paper on your head. At the age, he was in his 60s at that time. But Prabhupada, he was prepared to do anything to print his Srimad Bhagavatam. So he had to go to the paper wala, then walk to the printer, and then check every page of the Bhagavatam for mistakes. Because in those days they used the letterpress type of printing. Nowadays we use the offset printing. But letterpress, you could, sometimes the type was faded. Sometimes it was upside down because it was all done by hand. So Prabhupada had to personally check. Plus he did all his editing himself. He was a one-man operation. So the devotees, they came there and they wanted to show me that the temple that they built, they added two floors. And this is the deity that Prabhupada worshipped while he was at Chippewada. Prabhupada explains in various conversations that he always had the opportunity to live in the temple since he was a little boy. When he was a little boy and in college, he lived at the Radha Govinda Temple in Calcutta. Then as he was married in Bombay, he lived at a temple in Bombay where he had his office. And in Allahabad, he would also be attending the Gaudiya Math Temple in Allahabad. He was always in the temple, and he never ever ate in a hotel. He always took his prasadam in a dharmshala. Or if someone who was intimate and friendly with Prabhupada, he would take his prasadam at their house. But he very rarely accepted invitations to eat in the houses of grihasthas. Mostly he was independent. So the devotees, they wanted me to advertise their temple. You can pass these around. And there's a map showing where the temple is. And they also printed these posters of the Sri Vallabha Mandir in Chippewada. And I was a little confused about this story, because in the Lilamrita it mentions that the Chippewada temple was called the Radha Krishna temple. It wasn't called the Sri Vallabha temple. The Sri Vallabha temple existed some years later. Prabhupada stayed at a Sri Vallabha temple, Sri Radha Vallabha temple in Chandichok for a few months, where he gave darshan and pravachan. So I was thinking, why have they changed the name from Radha Krishna to Sri Vallabha? Because the temple, it was known as Radha Krishna. Even Prabhupada said when he got off the plane in 1967, he didn't go to Vrindavan right away. He went to the Chippewada temple, to the Radha Krishna temple. And the 40 rupees that he was allotted to him by the government to go to America, he used those 40 rupees to pay for the taxi, which he said he got cheated. So I inquired from the temple president of the Chippewada temple, did you change the name to Radha Vallabha? Because it was known as Radha Krishna. He said no. In the original deed of the property of the Chippewada temple, the deed is in the name of the Sri Radha Vallabha temple. Their Lordship, Sri Radha Vallabha. So the original deed is in the name of Sri Radha Vallabha. So they gave me a bunch of these posters. You're the first one, so you can have one. If you want one yourself, you have to come to the evening program in Prabhupada's house, where I will continue talking about Prabhupada, and you'll get a free poster of the Sri Radha Vallabha Mandir. Very nice deities. Prabhupada worshipped these deities. And it's historical, because they're at least hundreds of years old, these deities. Did everybody get one of these? People who didn't get, it gives you a map how to get there. So you should visit, because it's a historical site, because of Prabhupada staying there. So before I begin, I always like to play this bhajan of Prabhupada. To me, it shows the ecstatic symptoms of Prabhupada singing Hare Krishna mantra, and it's my most favorite bhajan. And I'd just like to play a few minutes of it before we start on the incorporation, how ISKCON became incorporated.
Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare Hare
bhajans that Prabhupada sang of the Hare Krishna mantra. It's my best hearing of the Hare Krishna mantra. So I wanted to share that with the other Vaishnavas. Now, we really have to go back in time about the incorporation. Prabhupada always had a plan to have a society. He tried in India with the League of Devotees, which was very successful. He had all the intelligent people of Jhansi coming, and he incorporated a society called the League of Devotees. And doctors and professors, they were all coming to these lectures. The only thing is that Prabhupada said there was a problem. Nobody would give their son to assist him in his preaching work, because Prabhupada was an elderly person. He couldn't do everything himself. He had one man, Prabhakar, who had Harinam initiation. He was the actual cause for getting this property on a very long lease. It belonged to a cinema owner in Jhansi. But Prabhupada was very concerned that the intelligentsia would not give any of their sons to this movement. And that's why he was more and more contemplating leaving India, where he could get and make devotees. He said India had lost its culture. This was way back in the 50s. India had lost its culture. It was more important to get a diploma, to get a technical diploma, and then become unemployed. Because that's the result, especially now in India. You have hundreds and thousands. I know where I stay, there are many boys there who have diplomas and they're cleaning bathrooms. Well, you don't have to go to school to clean a bathroom. Even I used to clean Prabhupada's bathroom, and I never cleaned a bathroom in my whole life because I had a servant to do that. Something new for me, and we lived in a house like this. You can see in the woods, 22-room house. We had servants. This was the gate. You couldn't enter, and the chokidar opened the gate in America. And this is another view. We had a lake, a swimming pool. So we had... It used to belong to the president of General Electric. So when I cleaned Prabhupada's bathroom, that was my first job. Hare Krishna. All glory. Hare Bol. When I cleaned Prabhupada's bathroom, I had to meditate. And first, how do you do, what do you do to clean a bathroom? What do you use? Your hand? A rag? A brush? I didn't know. So it took me about 10 minutes to assimilate the function of cleaning a bathroom. But it was very enjoyable. I regretted leaving my 22-room house to clean Prabhupada's bathroom. It was more enjoyable to clean his bathroom and to wash his clothes than to live in a 22-room house with a washing machine. We didn't have a washing machine at 26 Second Avenue. So, in this regard, Brahmananda, he says, he mentions about the incorporation.
What is the significance of the incorporation? Why is it significant? The significance is not for what it was, but what it was going to become.
You have to understand, when the incorporation took place, if you've ever read the papers of the incorporation, actually Prabhupada incorporated in the League of Devotees, and the incorporation in New York was not written by Srila Prabhupada. It was actually written by Hari Griva, based on the incorporation of Jhansi. This is the original incorporation of Jhansi. And, you know, it's a big document. It gives the what we're supposed to do. It's a very large document. If you want it, you can get it from me later. It's about 20 pages long. But the idea is, when you read the document, when the society was incorporated on July 13th, 1966, none of the objects of this document existed. There was no sankirtan. There was no preaching. There wasn't any making devotees and building temples. There was nothing. So Prabhupada incorporated a society which in practice did not exist. It was only existing on paper. Let's see. This is Prabhupada's vision. It's a vision that he maintained throughout his whole life. Just as he envisioned this temple in the middle of nowhere. When we came here first, this road was the Chattakara Road was just a little road. It was a lane. It wasn't even a road. It was like a bicycle lane. There were no vehicles. And we were wondering, because we were so far away from Vrindavan town, who's going to come here? That was our vision. Our limited, peeny, teeny, weeny vision. But we couldn't come to the level of a Mahabhagavat's vision. And now we see that vision 50 years later, how this place has become the most important place in all of Vrindavan. Everybody who comes to Vrindavan, they have to stop at this temple to see the deities, to see the paintings, to see the samadhi. It's the most important place in all of Vrindavan. Even the people who live here say that the worship of our deities is the best of any temple in Vrindavan. So this was Prabhupada's vision. Now, he wanted to actually start a society practically as soon as he got here. He wanted to start. He wrote a letter to Srimati Maharaji about 3 weeks or a month after he arrived in America. He arrived in September, late September of 1965. It took 40 days to cross the ocean. So in that letter to Srimati Maharaji, you have to excuse me, I have some cataracts, so I can't see so well. But, and also the ribbon that Prabhupada was using wasn't so bright. Ribbons were expensive in those days. So I wish that you may take up the idea of preaching work a little more seriously. That I want that immediately a society for this purpose may be formed, and that will be recognized by the government for cultural activity. And he also wanted Srimati Maharaji to send a Sankirtan party, because he didn't think the Americans would go on the street and chant Hare Krishna. This is 1965. This is a year, almost a year before ISKCON started. So, but he was thinking in his mind of a society and of a Sankirtan party. He had so many dreams and aspirations how to carry on the Hare Krishna movement. We can see that in the letters he wrote, the 6,500 letters, that Prabhupada was personally managing 108 centers all over the world and directing each of his lieutenants, the GBC, temple presidents, and regular devotees who worked under them. He was directing them to different parts of the world. He was like the CEO, chief executive officer. But he was a hands-on CEO, not a desk CEO. The desk CEO sits at his desk all day and falls asleep. But Prabhupada was actually traveling and checking on the institution that he started. 14 times around the world, spending 3, 4, 5, 6 days, 2 weeks in each temple to train up the devotees how to manage and how to increase the Harinam Sankirtan, increasing book distribution, increasing making devotees. In fact, he created the very first Ritviks in 1972. Did you know that? Who knew Ritviks started in 1972? Raise your hand. Nobody? Yeah, Prabhupada created Ritviks in 1972. He empowered. Actually, I looked up the word empowerment on the folio. Oh, boy. I found 1,500 hits. How to be empowered by the Lord and how to be empowered by the Guru, by Mahabhagwat. And Prabhupada empowered in 1972 two devotees to chant on the beats. And he said by this empowerment, he used the word empowerment, this will be as good as if I chanted on the beats. And those persons were Kirtananda for the America and Revatinanda Swami for Europe. But Prabhupada went even further. From 1972, 73, 74, 75, 76, he appointed like 40 critics. Not necessarily by the qualification of the person, because nobody had any qualification for doing anything. Prabhupada was doing everything through our energy, but we didn't have qualification on our own. So even he appointed Ritviks to do the second initiation. He even had women perform the fire sacrifice. And they would play the tape of the Gayatri Mantra in the ear, right ear, of the aspirant. Although Prabhupada wasn't present, He was present by the empowerment given to that devotee. Look at it this way, a powerhouse. We have a big powerhouse. And from that powerhouse, there's little teeny weeny powerhouses all over the city that empowers and gets electricity from the big powerhouse. So that's what Prabhupada did. He spread his empowerment through the hearts of his devotees. Through their hearts. Of those who opened their hearts to Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada could tell just by looking at you if you were ready to have to open your heart to his authority, to his dictation, you see, to his instructions. And then he would give some of that empowerment to do a specific function in the society. Someone to manage the BBT, someone to manage the temple, someone to manage the deity worship. So many different empowerments were done by Srila Prabhupada. That's the strength of a Mahabhagwat. You see. So Prabhupada had it in his mind to start a society from the very beginning. When he came to America, he wasn't depressed. He didn't have any disciples. Sally Agarwal, who was the wife of his sponsor, she arranged programs for him to preach in churches and schools in Butler, Pennsylvania, where he spent 3 months. And he even wanted her to purchase a building. See, this is where Prabhupada stayed for 3 weeks. This is a hostel, the YMCA. And then they would either pick him up by car, and he would take his meals, and he would cook for Sally Agarwal. That's in their apartment building. And they had a two-year-old daughter. She's only 2 years old now. As soon as she saw Prabhupada, what did she call him? Swami Jesus. And the parents were shocked because they didn't say anything. And Prabhupada showed that even children can recognize a representative of God more than a grown-up, because a grown-up is corrupt with sense gratification, whereas a child is very innocent. And she addressed Prabhupada as Swami Jesus. So she knew right away, she was the first one to recognize Prabhupada as a Shaktavish avatar, a little girl, 2 years old. And we big men, we argue whether Prabhupada's a Shaktavish avatar. That shows you how less advanced we are. Whereas a little girl, baby, knows everything. You see. So anyway, Prabhupada had this idea for society. Now, how to make the society come about? You see, so back in First of all, he had no residence. So what would be the address of the society? There was no address. He stayed in this place after Butler. He stayed in a place called, it was an office building. It was an office building where Dr. Mishra had a yoga, I think it was on the second or third floor. He had a yoga ashram where they performed their exercises. Dr. Mishra, he was kind to Prabhupada, but at the same time, he criticized Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, you will not make any disciples wearing tilak and kunti mala and this dress. You have to wear a suit. If you wear a suit, then you'll get a lot of old ladies. You'll get money. In fact, when Prabhupada first arrived, the Swami Nikalayananda of the Ramakrishna Mission, they had a big building in a very prestigious part of New York, on the east side, a five-story building. Brahmananda went there, where he was offered a prasadam of chicken. Of course, he didn't eat it, because Brahmananda became a vegetarian before he met Prabhupada. But they were giving chicken for prasadam. Prabhupada said to me, well, it's written down, it was Swami Vivekananda who introduced chicken eating to the Bengalis. Before, Bengal never ate chicken. But Swami Vivekananda, he introduced this. Because he became a chicken eater in America. Prabhupada called it fried birds. He asked one devotee, oh, you eat fried bird? He didn't call it chicken, he called it fried bird. It kinds, when Prabhupada uses those words, it sounds a little bit disgusting, doesn't it? Fried bird. It's like taking a bird and frying it. Prabhupada was very poetic, and he hit the point by just the words he used to describe certain things. So anyway, how was Prabhupada going to form an institution? He had only people coming wherever he stayed. He had four or five acquaintances coming at the yoga where he stayed, the yoga ashram. Dr. Mishra gave him a little office room to sleep. It was a 10-by-10 room. There was no bathroom inside. He had to go outside the room. There was a bathroom, but there was no shower. So, and by staying in that room, the first thing Prabhupada did by selling his books was buy a tape recorder. And he wanted to tape record his lectures, whoever came, and his kirtans, and play the kirtans for the people in such a way that they would understand what is kirtan. They didn't know what kirtan is. They only knew yoga, how to breathe and move your legs and arms in different ways. That's all Americans knew. They didn't know anything. What's kirtan? What's this? This is not yoga. So Prabhupada had to reteach and make it attractable to the people who were coming. So he would record his own kirtans and then play it. And in February 21st, he recorded his first lecture, Introduction to the Gita Upanishad, which today has become the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. If you read the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita and you hear the original recording, which I have from February 1966, it should match. But sometimes it doesn't match because somebody did some finagling and changed some things. But actually, that is the original introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. And I printed it on the mimeograph machines. When we got the mimeograph machines, we printed back the Godhead. So anyway, one day, Prabhupada was always, during the day, active. He didn't just sit in his room. He was going to bookstores. He was going to government agencies, to the UN, to UNESCO, to every single library you could think of to distribute his books and preach. He was always outside, taking bus rides that cost 25 paisa in those days. So one day he comes back to his room, and the tape recorder and the typewriter is gone. Stolen. Somebody broke the window and took it. Everybody suspected the superintendent, the man in charge, but they couldn't prove anything. So then Prabhupada himself moved from the yoga ashram to his own room in the same building, where he had more security and more privacy. And he was paying $70 a month, which was a lot. Prabhupada had to do a lot of book selling. Of course, people who would come for his lectures, five or six, the average donation was $5. What's $5 now? It's 300 rupees? Well, back then, it was 6 rupees to a dollar, so he was getting 30 rupees a day, a night, for his lectures. He even taught Sanskrit. He had a Sanskrit class. He was teaching Sanskrit, and they would leave $2, $1. That was his collect. He was living on that, you see, on the generosity of others, and trying to distribute his books. So finally, he moved from this place. He was offered a place on the Bowery by this devotee called Haridas, Harvey Cohn. He actually made the first painting of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan painting. He was an artist, and he went to San Francisco, and he subleased his apartment to this other boy who invited Prabhupada to live with him, provided Prabhupada pay $100 a month, because the rent was $200. Now, this was called a loft. And for those of you who do not know what a loft is there's a sign in front of the building called AIR. Now, these lofts were 100 years old, and they used to be factories, garment factories, all kind of manufacturing. So the government, after these factories closed, the government turned these lofts into places for artists at government rates, reduced rates, only $200, you get like 3,000 square feet. So that's where Prabhupada stayed, and he found it very convenient. Although it was in the middle of the alcoholic part of town. There were 30,000 alcoholics and flop houses. Do you know what a flop house is? Well, you know. A flop house is a house where you go and flop down out of drunkenness and you pay 50 cents. And you urinate in your pants. You go to the bathroom number two in your pants and the whole place stinks. Now that's where 30,000 people lived, in flop houses. Or they just found the doorway and flopped down. Prabhupada sometimes had to step over these men, these stinking, rotting, urinated, stool-smelling men, and step over them to get into his loft. This is a Mahabhagwat of Vaikuntha man having to endure these things. This shows the greatness of Prabhupada, that he was, what's the word called in Sanskrit? Who's undisturbed? Dhira. He's Dhira. He's undisturbed by all these material anomalies. He can live in a palace or live near a flop house. For him, it's the same. That's a Mahabhagwat. He doesn't care for his own personal. So, Prabhupada, that was a very good move for Prabhupada. Because he was getting anywhere from 8 to 20 people a night coming to hear his lectures. 8 to 20 people were coming, but the collections weren't so much more. There were still $5, $6, $7, but he was able to distribute more books. So finally, he was getting a core of what I would call associates. You see, a core of associates were coming. Prabhupada used to do his writing there, and he would have Paul do the typing. This is a comment Prabhupada made on Gaur Purnima in March of 1966. He said, according to the Mayapur Panjika, today is the Adivist day of Gaur Purnima. Devotees at Vrindavan and Navadvipa are enjoying the celebration. But I am here alone, without any devotee companion. But I have come here to serve the Lord and not for personal happiness. I am prepared to live in hell even if I am able to serve the Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Wanted that this mission should be propagated all over the world, and that is my objective. I do not mind the inconvenience personally felt. This is Prabhupada's determination. This should be our determination to keep how Prabhupada started ISKCON. We should adopt this feeling without considering whether we will take prasadam or not prasadam, where we will sleep or where we will not sleep. Prabhupada had no devotee companions, you see. But still, he was determined to fulfill his objective. This is March of 66, before ISKCON. This is in February. Now, in February, I don't know how to make this bigger. There we go. Oops. This Prabhupada announced February 23rd in 1966. I beg to inform you that the classes which I am holding now may be called the initiation classes for developing the institution, the International Institution for God Consciousness. For the present, the classes may be held thrice in a week, namely Monday, Wednesdays, Friday, 7 to 9. The contribution for expenses may not be less than $1 for each meeting and $3 per week. Other days, though, I shall be available between 6 and 8 for discussion. There is no need of contribution. I hope you will all agree to this proposal and give your kind assent by signature. See, Prabhupada was trying to formulate a core of people. He didn't think of the word Krishna until later. Later, first it was going to be called God Consciousness. From League of Devotion to League of Devotees to God Consciousness. It was only in July that Prabhupada actually changed the word to Krishna Consciousness. Now, Brahmananda talks about the signing.
So what is this?
There were no devotees, no one. It just happened to show up. People would just happen to show up, you know, out of curiosity or whatever. So there was one who was kind of regular from the Bowery days, or Mukunda. His name was Michael Krim, and his wife, Jen, who became Janaki. So, he happened to be there that night, and there were a couple others. I mean, they were just casual acquaintances. So Prabhupada asked, so I want everybody to sign these papers. What papers? What is this? And they said, well, if the Swami wants, you know, he will do it. So they signed their name. They didn't know what they were signing. And they had no commitment. They weren't following the four regs, the regulations, or nothing. And, they had absolutely no qualification. And these signers would be trustees. So why did Prabhupada do that? So Prabhupada was following the principle that you utilize whatever you have. You utilize that in Krishna consciousness. No matter how, you know, insignificant. The process of Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada always said, is to fan the spark. You have a spark, and if you fan it, then it becomes fire. Or it may not, it may die out. That's the chance you take, but at least you try. That's what Prabhupada was doing.
So, Prabhupada chose people who weren't even, we didn't even know the rules and regulations in those days. I know one of the trustees was a chain smoker. He lived in the temple. He was a chain smoker, had his coffee and tea every morning before going to work, and constantly smoking cigarettes. I think everybody was smoking in those days. And these were the trustees. So this follows the philosophy of Rupa Goswami, that whatever you can utilize in Krishna consciousness, you utilize. And by the association, or what Ramananda described as fanning the spark of devotional service, gradually the purification takes place. Even Mukunda, he used to smoke a pipe when I met him. He'd smoke a pipe. But by the fanning process, the spark became fire. He started the temple in San Francisco. Started the Rath Yatra, the first Rath Yatra in 1966-67. He was in a pickup truck. They used a pickup truck. So the process works. Fanning the spark of devotional service, the process itself will work. You don't have to artificially lay down rules and regulations. Of course, every organization needs that as it grows, to have rules and regulations. But in the beginning, Prabhupada had to utilize whatever Krishna sent him. He didn't reject anybody. So, by the society, he was thinking of creating ISKCON in early May and June. And Karlapati, who was a musician, he used to give lots of money to Prabhupada, you know, small amounts, but he gave the $100 to this Stephen Goldsmith, who was the lawyer. And Mr. Goldsmith was a good lawyer, but he thought it very cool to serve a Swami from India with robes. He said, wow, this is cool. So he donated most of his time for making the documentation and submitting the incorporation to the state of New York as a religious society. And Prabhupada, he made up the constitution first. It's hard to see, but I don't know how to blow it up. Anyway, it's the Constitution, and then there was the Articles of Incorporation. And then the incorporation papers. This is the actual incorporation papers based on the John C. incorporation. And the signatories were people who were just guests, really. I mean, there was Carl and Raphael and Bob Leafley. All these people never lasted. Michael Grant, he stayed. James Green, he left. I mean, these were just acquaintances of Prabhupada, but Prabhupada initiated them anyway. And they were the trustees. They didn't even know what papers they were signing. They never read them. They just thought, well, if the Swami wants it, we'll do it. You see? And that's how ISKCON came into being. In this regard, Brahmananda wants to remark about this.
And you have to realize that what these purposes are, I mean, have absolutely no relation to what there was. What there was just Prabhupada sitting on a mat.
The articles of incorporation, the ISKCON will do this, 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 did not exist in reality. There was nothing. It only existed on paper.
Prabhupada wasn't seeing what there was, but he was seeing what it would become. That's the brilliance. And nobody else had that vision. I mean, when I joined in August, a month later after the incorporation. And then Prabhupada made me the president. But we were just doing our activities in the storefront, you know, there on the Lower East Side, to the counterculture youth, the alternative generation. I mean, we never even went above 14th Street. 14th Street was the demarcation. It's like 14th Street was the land of conformity.
See, we lived down below 14th Street. 14th Street was the place for people who were against everything, anything that conformed to society. And when you went above 14th Street, that represented society. Everybody was conforming to everything. Everybody had a job, went to work, had kids. And below 14th Street were the revolutionaries, the social revolutionaries. So that we had our little ghetto there at 26th Second Avenue, because everybody there was a revolutionary, was against conformity. You see? So it's very ironic that those who were the most non-conformists we're listening to the lectures of a person who's the most conformist, the most regulated, the most following rules and regulations and schedules. And we were sitting there listening to that person that we were actually against by the way of life we chose to be nonconforming, revolutionary, anarchy. And Prabhupada represented the most straight person you've ever want to meet, full of rules and regulations and this and that, which we didn't even know till he posted them on the doors. He gave the 26 qualifications of a devotee on a door. Oh, we looked at that. We said, we're finished. We can't do those. To be sane, we're all insane. In fact, to be insane was good in those days. The more insane you were, the better sane you were. That was the called it the alternative culture, the subculture, the hippie culture, the beatniks culture. And that was the Lower East Side. And here we're following someone who's telling us what to do, when to get up. We got up when we wanted to get up. And he's telling us we got to get up for arti. That was revolution. Get up. Who wants to get up? And when to go to sleep? I'll go to sleep when I go to sleep. So this is what Prabhupada was teaching. He was choosing the most fallen, the most demoniac people who had no schedule, no slept when they wanted to sleep, ate what they wanted to eat, had sex with anyone who they wanted to have sex with. And here's Prabhupada telling us how to regulate our lives. It was mind-blowing. You see? But we kept it. We kept staying with the Swami. We kept hearing him and hearing him. We were determined to hear what he had to say because everything sounded logical. We were not stupid. We were educated.
And below 14th Street was the land of nonconformity. And we were all nonconformists. Of course, we thought that, you know, Hare Krishna was the ultimate in nonconformity because it was so strange. You know, it was Indian, the dress, this, that, I mean, everything. I mean, Prabhupada was the ultimate nonconformist, walking in his robes with these white rubber shoes.
See, physically, Prabhupada looked as a nonconformist. I mean, it was great to hang out with the Swami because he wore these robes and these rubber shoes. He ate the strange kind of food we never heard of. He ate these black chilies that burned your mouth out and you had to run to the bathroom. I mean, we never experienced that. There were no Indian restaurants in those days. There were Pakistani restaurants, but there was no, and nobody ate in them because they served meat. Most of us were vegetarians either joining or before we met Prabhupada because that was nonconformist, not to eat meat. If you didn't eat meat in the 60s, people said, you're nuts. You're a bugler if you didn't eat meat. You see? But we represented the nonconformist, and Prabhupada looked like the nonconformist. And we loved to hang out with him and walk with him in the streets to show I'm a nonconformist and I'm associating with this Swami who's a nonconformist. But in his heart, Prabhupada was the most conformist. His philosophy was the most conformist. You see?
Of course, what Prabhupada was teaching was the ultimate conformity. It wasn't nonconformity, it was conformity. There were rules and regulations. Everything scheduled. You know, everything very strictly. How you appeared, what you ate, how you dressed, what you read, what you, you know, everything.
So, this way, Prabhupada was attracting a lot of devotees. And very quickly, finally, he had $200. And on July 1st, he moved into his apartment and storefront. After that, he had no more money. It was $200. It was $75 for the apartment and $125 for the storefront. And he just sat on a mat. It was just a mat. Yeah, I got a picture of it someplace. Well, not that one. Yeah, sitting on the mat. This is what Prabhupada sat on. He sat on a mat. There were no chairs or anything. And in front of him, he had his little steel suitcase where he kept his clothes, and on top of it, he used it as a desk. And that's all he had. And in the storefront, he just sat on a mat. There was no furniture. There was nothing. I mean, it was so simple that this is what it actually looked like. When Prabhupada walked by it, I mean, it was next to a gas station, and we wrote here, 26 Second Avenue, come to Kirtan, Mondays, right, Wednesday. Well, look at that. Who would come into a place like that? You're just writing on some wood. This is 1966 in July. But with Prabhupada's transcendental vision, this became ISKCON in 1976, a skyscraper building. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Just by his determination, we had 300 devotees in a skyscraper building. Prabhupada said, you could bury me in this building. It was made, this building wasn't made of reinforced concrete. This is made of steel girders. Huge steel. That's how they build skyscrapers in America. They don't use reinforced concrete. They use steel, big steel girders lifted up. They last forever. Even the doors were made of steel. Of course, there was a reason for that. It used to be a mental hospital. So at night, you'd hear screams. Ah! Some ghost came to some devotee's room and probably jumped on his stomach. So we had to spend the first month ridding the place of the ghosts by going room to room and doing Harinam just to get rid of the ghosts, because so many people had torturous deaths there. You know, in a mental hospital back in the 30s, wasn't a very pleasant place. But anyway, this became Prabhupada's center in New York from poverty. And he loved to sit on the roof. That's the Empire State Building, right here. He loved to sit on the roof, showing this is the culmination of his preaching in 10 years. This reminds me of a scholar in London who said what took the Christian religion 300 years to develop after the death of Christ, your Guru Maharaj achieved in 10 years. In 10 years, he made a new religion in the West, whereas Christianity also came from the desert, but it took 300 years for it to come to the West. And here at Prabhupada's religion, which also came from the desert, Prabhupada said Vrindavan, he would go on a walk. He said, oh, he'd look at a plant. He said, oh, desert is coming, by looking at a plant. So he came from a desert, from Vrindavan, and in 10 years he made a new religion. So he's better than Christ, more powerful than Jesus Christ. You see? That's the power of a pure devotee of the Lord. So we were finally on July 6th, 6 days after Prabhupada moved into the new temple, we got the papers of incorporation as a religious entity. But we had a problem. What was that problem? The Vietnam War. Under the rules of the draft, you know what the draft is? In India, do you have a draft where you have to be drafted into the army? Or you go by yourself? I think you go by yourself. But in America, they had compulsory draft. Everybody who was not working or not going to a school was drafted into the army to fight in Vietnam. There were 500,000 people there. And it was good for America because they got rid of all the unemployment by sending all the unemployed to Vietnam to get killed. So what happened is all the devotees were getting drafted. Tamal Krishna, me, Achyutananda, everybody, Upendra. I didn't know anyone who was not being drafted, except for people who were older. But anyone who was in less than 20, 22 years old, they were all getting drafted, which means you had to go to Vietnam and fight. And nobody wanted to go to Vietnam to kill women and children, because that's who died. 4 million women and children were being killed by napalm. Do you know what napalm is? It's a jelly. and it doesn't come off your skin. When you get hit by napalm, you burn to death alive. There's nothing you can do. And they were using that. So now what to do? How to keep the devotees that we did have from getting drafted? Certainly not because you're incorporated by a state. No, we needed another paper. Another paper was required, the secret paper. That secret paper is this. What does it say? U.S. Treasury Department, Internal Revenue, Income Tax. We had to apply for tax exemption. You see? And Stephen Goldsmith helped us with that. These were the names of the trustees. Michael Grant was Mukunda. Jan Oslin, I think, was Janaki. Where's mine? Paul Gardner, he was the landlord. he didn't even come around. No, Paul Gardner was the who lived in the loft. And Donald Chaplin, he was from Montreal. Raymond Maharis, he became Ray Rama. He became the editor of Back to Godhead, and he would edit also Bhagavad Gita. Carl Jurgens, he helped Prabhupada in the beginning, but then he disappeared. Raphael Balsam, he, once Prabhupada pasted the rules and regulations on the door, he was gone. We never saw him again. And Bob Lefkowitz, he had mental problems. But Prabhupada loved him a lot because he did a lot of service. He used to bring Prabhupada money, beg money on the street, and give Prabhupada $5-$10 at a time. But he also disappeared. Then it gives the president, Bruce Scharf, President, Secretary Steve Guarino, Treasurer Gregory M. Sharp, myself. So this was submitted in November 66, after the incorporation. Now, why was this paper important? Who can guess why? More important than the incorporation. In fact, we should celebrate this day. Because we didn't have to get drafted anymore into the army because of this paper. Because of this paper, if we got it, first of all, to get tax exemption wasn't easy. It was a 50-50 chance. So one day, it was about 2-3 weeks after, in November, I got the letter. They addressed it to me because I was a treasurer. And my hands were shaking. Should I open this or not? Will it be positive or negative? Because it meant the future of the organization to survive. If all our men were going to be drafted, how would we preach and pull on? So I opened the letter nervously and I read it, and it was positive. You are hereby qualified as a nonprofit religious organization. And I ran up to Prabhupada and I said, "We got it." And Prabhupada was very happy. Because then when Prabhupada wrote a letter to the Selective Service or Draft Board, he would include this, showing that the federal government of the United States of America have accepted us as a religious, bona fide religion of America. And therefore, we do not hesitate, Prabhupada says, we will not hesitate in going into the army. However, we must go in as priests. Because Prabhupada wanted us to preach to the soldiers, Krishna consciousness. He wasn't against going in, but we shouldn't have to fight. We should go in as priests so we could preach. And with all the anxiety of the soldiers, and to hear Krishna conscious, oh, we'd have a big audience. But of course the army didn't want a bunch of Hare Krishnas walking around in robes, preaching to the soldiers, don't fight, chant Hare Krishna. So we didn't get drafted. But Prabhupada was ready for that, to go and preach to the... So he said, this is great opportunity by Krishna. He said, great opportunity to spread Krishna conscious amongst... Because nobody wanted to fight. And if we could preach non-violence and chant Hare Krishna, you know, then... this would be better. We could preach Bhagavad Gita. Is Krishna on the battlefield? No. It's some president, corrupt president who's running this war, not Krishna. Oh, we'd have so many followers, the war would end. But that didn't happen. Actually, our men weren't ready to be big preachers. We didn't have any books in 66 anyway. So we weren't very good at preaching in those days. What time is it now? 9:40. So anyway, we're up to that point of getting the tax exemption. Prabhupada didn't care about the tax exemption because people were only giving us $5 anyway, so there was no question of tax exemption. He wanted to be recognized by the federal government. That made us bona fide as a bona fide religion of the United States of America, and that was the importance. So we'll end there. This evening we'll go on with more of the old stories about ISKCON in the old days. I just want to play on the ending part a nice kirtan written to Vishnu John, the late Vishnu John. I have confidence in you because Krishna has given you special talent for chanting Hare Krishna mantra. When you were chanting in LA temple in the evenings or in the mornings, I enjoyed your chanting so nicely that I thought myself immediately carried to Vaikuntha. That's what he said about Vishnu John. So this tape is very nice, because Prabhupada is playing the mridanga. Oh,
Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare.
Ah!
Thank you very much. All glories to the assembled devotees. Those who are more interested can come this evening at 5:30 at Prabhupada's house. And we'll talk more about the old days and how his Sangha got started and Prabhupada's great and visionary vision about the future of ISKCON. Hari Bol.